I get paid large sums of money to kill children. I'll let that horrific sentence sink in before I tell you what I really do for a living. More specifically, I move children from horrific situations with parents, guardians, and wicked people, and place them with someone who will watch over them, take care of them, not want them dead. How and why do I do this? We'll get back to the nitty-gritty in a bit. For now, how much money to kill my daughter? I frowned and stared at the man. Without an answer, I walked to his office desk and sat down in the guest chair and motioned for him to join me. I put my satchel on the floor within easy reach. He took his time, trying to seem casual, walking around his desk and dropping into his chair. I noticed things. A picture of his daughter was on the filing cabinet to my right. His hands were shaking, and he couldn't make eye contact. He was sweating, despite the air turned down low, and when I'd first walked into his office, I noticed his secretary was not at her desk. John Caruso was one of the big-shot lawyers in Philadelphia, but I would be stupid not to do my job and figure out the background of a potential client before we met. This guy had a couple of red flags, and I was going to have my due diligence with John before we went any further. Peter Rabbit by Beatrix Potter. Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits, and their names were Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and Peter. They lived with their mother in a sandbank underneath the root of a very big fir tree.
"Now, my dears," said old Mrs. Rabbit one morning, "you may go into the fields or down the lane, but don't go into Mr. McGregor's garden. Your father had an accident there. He was put in a pie by Mrs. McGregor. Now run along and don't get into mischief. I am going out."
Then old Mrs. Rabbit took a basket and her umbrella to the baker's. She bought a loaf of brown bread and 5 currant buns. Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail, who were good little bunnies, went down the lane to gather blackberries. But Peter, who was very naughty, ran straight away to Mr. McGregor's garden and squeezed under the gate. Pot On and Aura by Ken Brody. With the CEO in transit, there was no one to stop him. So McHugh, a balding man with a fringe of white hair and an Irish temper, was standing in the lab area, red in the face, and lecturing Sarah and Deepak.
"I don't know what you eggheads doing here all day, and frankly, I don't care. What I see is more of these defective exoplac modules coming back in than we have going out. And you say you don't even know what the problem is. Didn't you invent the damn things? How is it you don't know how they work?"
Deepak bobbed his head. "Aura was the inventor. All we did was follow her patent and her instructions. But Aura is gone."
"So put her back together. Isn't that supposed to be what you're good for? I got $500 million order to fill, and you had better do whatever it is you do. But get those defective units fixed and out of here. If it was up to me, I'd fire the lot of you and bring in someone who can make things work."
Solomon's Gold by Alex Lukman.
"What do you make of what Friedman sent you?"
Alan Friedman was the director of the Jewish Museum in New York, the oldest museum of Jewish history in the world. He'd sent pictures of a scroll to her, asking for help in translating it.
"It's fascinating," Selena said. "It's written in biblical Hebrew."
"What does it say?"
"I can't read it yet," Selena said. "It's written in code."
"Codes were pretty simple back then," Nick said. "It should be relatively easy to crack. It's not like what they do today."
"That's true, but it could be unique to the person who wrote this, in which case I may not be able to translate it."
"Whoever wrote it, someone else would have to be able to understand it. Otherwise, why write it in the first place?"
"Sure, but that doesn't make it any easier. Codes were common in biblical days. The various armies used them. Merchants used them to conceal things from their competitors.